We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
In this hour of focus, we'll be talking about North Korea. North Korea is one of the world's most closed societies, certainly making it very challenging to understand the policies of its government. North Korea is also a nuclear power, and some people would say that certainly makes it vital that we try to understand the policies of its government. We'll talk a little bit about a recent uptick in tensions between the North and South, also talk a little bit about the country's leadership and how that may or may not change. And questions from people who are listening are certainly welcome. Our guest for this hour focus is Clark Sorensen. He's an associate professor at the Henry M. Jackson School of International Studies at the University of Washington and in Seattle, and has been studying about and writing about Korea for some time. We're glad to have him joining us. He's on the telephone. And as we talk, questions are welcome from people who are listening. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do that by dialing us up here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us. And so if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. And you can also email questions if you'd like to do it like that. And the address is will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, if you have questions, comments, you are welcome to join in the conversation. And Professor Sorensen, hello.
Good morning. How are you?
I am fine. Thanks. How are you?
Good.
Good. Well, thanks very much for being with us. We appreciate it. It certainly seems that in some respects, last year, the year 2010, was not a particularly good one for relations between North and South Korea, or perhaps between the North and the rest of the world, as we saw the sinking of a South Korean military vessel, this exchange of artillery fire in November between the North and the South, and then also in November the revelation that the government of North Korea had built a plant that we did not know about until they told us, had built a plant to enrich uranium. So I'd like to maybe talk a little bit about those things. Going back first to last March and the sinking of the South Korean ship, the Cheonan, I think at the time there was some suspicion that North Korea might have had something to do with it. Then eventually evidence was presented by the government of South Korea that, in fact, it was a torpedo, a North Korean torpedo, that hit the boat and sunk it. 46 sailors were killed. And I think that it left a lot of people sort of scratching their head and saying, well, if that indeed is the case, why would North Korea have done something like that? What do we know about this?
We never know why North Korea does stuff. Figuring out North Korea is like reading tea leaves. My personal view is that the North Korean military is not closely monitored by the top people in Pyongyang, and they often freelance. And there have been naval clashes in the West Sea where this clash took place for years. South Koreans sank a North Korean ship some years ago, and it may very well have been a revenge attack, in my view.
Then there was this exchange of artillery fire. There was this shelling by the North, although I think that each side has said the other side shot first, of this island, Yeongpyeong Island. Four people were killed. I think initially, while there might have been some uncertainty about what happened with the Cheonan, this seemed to be much more clear. At least the South Koreans felt that the North Koreans had shot first, and this certainly looked like an act of war, again leading people to ask this question, well, if indeed the North had initiated this exchange and they'd been the ones that had fired first, why in the world that they would have done this?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Clearly they wanted to be clearly implicated in this one, whereas in the Cheonan sinking they went to a lot of trouble to not be implicated.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a different dynamic going on. Very often they've engaged in provocations to reset the diplomatic calendar in Northeast Asia. And in this case, nothing's happened since the breakdown of the six-party talks at the end of 2007. The U.S. hasn't been talking with them, and China's been pretty happy with that, and clearly North Korea is not happy with it. So I think it's kind of interesting. North Korea is unhappy with the United States not talking with them. Their relations with South Korea have cooled since the election of President Lee Myung-bak in 2008, and they're trying to reset the button. I think it's also noteworthy that they're not exactly happy with China's ignoring of them either, and that's kind of a new wrinkle in the situation right now.
Mm-hmm. I have a caller here, and I will get to in a moment, and we can talk some more about a number of things here, but let me just ask you about one thing in particular. There, for some time now, there have been questions about the health of the current leader of the country, Kim Jong-il, and how much longer he would be in power and who would succeed him. And it seems that recently we've gotten something of an answer, that it would appear that one of his sons, Kim Jong-un is his name, it would appear that he's the one, at least his father, would like to succeed him. And again, we can talk more about that. There apparently are also some questions about whether or not that's his position, that is, Kim Jong-un's position, is firmly established or not. But there apparently is some thinking that this, particularly the shelling of Yongpyeong, had something to do with his trying to establish some sort of military credentials for him, for Kim Jong-un. Do you think that that is a plausible sort of story?
That's one of the big theories that's out there. It has a certain amount of plausibility. Last October, they had a Korean Workers' Party delegates conference, which is the first time they've had a national conference since 1980. In 1980, when they had a national party conference, that was when Kim Jong-il, the current leader, was confirmed as the successor. So a lot of people thought that the same thing would happen for Kim Jong-un in October. That may have happened in October. However, it's not been publicly announced yet.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Clark Sorensen. He is associate professor in the Henry M. Jackson School of International Studies at University of Washington, Seattle, and a longtime observer of Korea, both Koreas. We're talking specifically about North Korea, and the questions are welcome, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's go to Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Oh, yes. Well, there are some other facts in the public record. For example, the sinking of the Chonan. There you had high-speed naval maneuvers at night by the United States and the Republic of Korea right off the coast of North Korea in disputed territorial waters. And there's really no evidence to believe that North Korea sank the ship. The odds are just as well there was a collision or they hit a reef or something like that. There was never any outside impartial investigation by a UN body or something like that. As for the shelling, actually, we now have a new president in South Korea, President Ma, who has repudiated the sunshine policy, peace policy of his two predecessors. And he was the one who proceeded to engage in massive shelling right off the coast of North Korea. North Korea had told them that, you know, if you go ahead and do this, we'll respond. And they did respond by shelling that island, unfortunately, but it was minor compared to the massive shelling engaged in by the ROK. And then quite recently then, and of course, Ma is doing all this at the behest and with the cooperation and approval of the Obama administration. And then recently, you know, then they send over, Obama sends over a supercarrier to intimidate North Korea on hostile military maneuvers right off their coast. And then they threaten more naval shelling from that same island onto North Korea. And North Korea said they will respond. And it's very clear that within the past month alone, the Obama administration was fully prepared to set off a resumption of the Korean War. And the only thing to stop this, to prevent a resumption of the Korean War, was pressure put by China on North Korea not to retaliate on the second round of shelling. So I would submit to all of your listeners out there that the expert here from the Henry Jackson School, Jackson, well-known neoconservative cold warrior, and everyone they have at the Jackson School is well-known as a neoconservative cold warrior. So I would take with a grain of salt anything the so-called expert is saying. Thank you.
All right. Well, I don't know how you might want to respond to that, Professor Sorensen. I guess I am interested in your response to the or your thoughts on the suggestion of the caller that the actions of North Korea were in response to provocation by the South, perhaps with the support of the United States.
Well, it's a complicated issue. There's a northern sea boundary that's disputed. South Korea has some islands very close off the coast of North Korea in the West Sea. And South Korea and the United States consider the boundary, the sea boundary, the halfway point between these islands and North Korea, whereas North Korea does not accept that sea boundary. So when the South Koreans started their military, their shelling, they were actually shelling away from the North Korean coast. It was live shell exercise, but it was out to sea. North Korea considered it provocative, and so it went on from there. The South Koreans did respond, and some shells hit the North Korean coast. So far as I know, there was no loss of life in North Korea. As for the Chun'an, there was an international group that looked over the sinking with an international group invited by the South Korean government. Their conclusions have been disputed by some people. The idea that it went aground, however, isn't plausible because it split apart almost immediately and went under, you know, went to the bottom of the ocean, and that's not consistent with just running aground.
Hmm.
So, you know, there's a lot of complex issues involved.
On the subject of the exchange of artillery fire, I guess I did find myself thinking right at the time when I first heard about it and thinking as a layperson and not an expert that this was a very serious matter and that the potential for escalation here was great.
Oh yeah.
The caller said, well, it didn't happen because the North Koreans were reined in by the Chinese. And I suppose yet in my mind the question is, well, indeed, how is it that this did not escalate any further than it went?
I don't know how the North Koreans made their decision. China has less influence on North Korea than a lot of people think, and I imagine it was a North Korean decision not to escalate.
Let's just to continue with the question of the Chinese. It seems that in everything one reads, there is indeed this suggestion that the country that's in the best position to exercise any influence over North Korea is China.
Right.
Now, for their part, I think actually the Chinese say they don't think that they have that kind of influence. And if they do, some people would suggest that, in fact, they haven't been that eager to use it. That just you, from what you're saying, that you say you think that, in fact, this idea that the Chinese have a lot of leverage as far as the North Koreans are concerned is really not the case.
Well, they have leverage, but they hesitate to use it, and it's a complicated situation. They value the existence of North Korea as a buffer state between a close U.S. ally, which is what South Korea is. So they don't want North Korea to collapse. North Korea doesn't listen to them unless they're willing to put on serious pressure, but if they put too much serious pressure on North Korea might very well collapse. So China finds itself between a rock and a hard place, that on the one hand, it would wish that North Korea was a little bit more cooperative and didn't provoke the U.S. to military buildup in Northeast Asia. But on the other hand, they don't want to put so much pressure on North Korea that North Korea collapses because they value the existence of North Korea. So they find North Korea a very difficult problem to deal with.
Our guest in this part of Focus is Clark Sorensen. He is associate professor at the Jackson School of International Studies, University of Washington in Seattle. We're talking about, primarily we're talking about North Korea. I'm sure we'll have some things to say about South Korea. You can't really, I don't think you could really talk about one without talking about the other. And questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. It would certainly seem that public opinion in the South after these incidents that we've talked about, particularly that last November, the shelling of Yongpyong Island, one reads that attitudes toward the North have turned harder, and whether or not that was already there, that we already had a government that was in position to take a harder line toward the North, I don't know. But what can one say now about what people in the South are thinking about in regards to the North?
Yeah, the South had what was called a sunshine policy toward the North from about 2000 until about 2008. And in the sunshine policy, South Korea gave North Korea pretty much unconditional aid as a way of reducing tensions. And there was a reduction in tensions as a result of the sunshine policy. But the South Korean public started feeling after the nuclear test in 2006 that maybe they weren't getting enough for their aid. Some people felt betrayed by the nuclear test. And the election of the conservative president in 2008, who reversed that policy, was partly related to disillusionment with the lack of progress between North and South relations. There was real progress between North and South relations, but just not as much as South Koreans hoped there would be. Once President Lee Myung-bak came into power, which is in 2008, he reversed much of the sunshine policy, and North Korea reacted rather negatively. And so since 2008-2009, relations between North and South Korea have been much chillier than they were earlier in this decade.
Hmm. And interestingly enough, though, now since the first of the year, given that there was this conflict last year between the two, early in the year, the government of the North said, well, they were interested in resuming talks with the South, and they hinted at the possibility they might even be willing to return to the talks. The six-party talks involving the North and South plus U.S., China, Japan, and Russia, that they might even be willing to come back. And in fact, the government of South Korea has just recently said, okay, they were willing to talk with the North. These are what are considered to be low-level talks. And before they go any further, apparently the government of the South has said, well, the government of the North is going to have to own up to both the Cheonan incident and apologize for Yongpyong, all of that, which seems not very likely. But at least here now the two sides are talking again, which given where they were just a couple of months ago seems a little surprising.
Yeah. When the Lee Myung-bak administration came in, one of the things they did, which I think was an error on their part, was that they linked progress between North and South relations to progress on the nuclear talks. And since the nuclear talks had broken down by 2008, there was really no progress between North and South Korea. They've kind of backtracked on that a little bit, and both the U.S. and South Korea are cautiously exploring more talks with North Korea, although I don't think there's much hope of the six-party talks themselves restarting. They broke down just as they seemed about to reach a success. So probably, maybe they'll be restarted cautiously, but not quickly. When you read the North Korean 2011 New Year's address, they seem to have pretty much a soft line on resuming talks, and their talk about it has been quite moderate for them. So when I was looking at the nuclear address, they were saying things like, since war will inevitably lead to nuclear disaster, they need to expedite dialogue and North-South cooperation. They want peace in Northeast Asia and complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, and so forth. So these are reiterating policy positions that they've had in the past. So I think it's likely that North Korea will agree to talk if the U.S. wants them and if South Korea wants them. The problem is that the U.S. feels it's been burned several times in the six-party talks, that we've gotten very close to an agreement, and then at the last minute it's fallen apart. Sometimes the fallout has been on the U.S. side, sometimes it's been on the North Korean side, but they never seem to quite go through in the end. And since 2008, North Korea seems to have been moving toward recreating their more traditional economy, retreating from economic reform, reconstituting the party and putting it more centrally into the organization of the society. So it may be that North Korea isn't really ready to make too many concessions at this point.
All right. We have a couple of callers here. Fisher is up to next, line number one. Hello.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Question and a comment. First comment. I'm a farmer. I'm, of course, not an expert in North and South Korean relations. However, I did participate in the evaluation of some agricultural projects in North Korea at the end of November. And our trip was scheduled to leave on November 26th, of course, which was 3 days after the shelling. And, you know, I, of course, was concerned that that the trip would be carried out, but there was no delay. We were allowed access. In North Korea, there was, of course, the awareness of the situation, but there was no really preparation for any possible escalation of, you know, aggression. While at the same time, as I listened to CNN, the South, of course, was preparing for, you know, possible retaliation. And I guess I want to affirm what the previous caller had said about, you know, the situation that was with the Cheonan and the other events that occurred, that there, and most of these disputes are related to the maritime border, and of which, of course, there are North and South have a disagreement as to where that line would be. While on land, the DMZ is quite clear, but in the ocean, my question to the guest is, why has there not been an ability of the two sides to agree upon this line?
There was progress in negotiating about the line under the previous president. The current president has been more conservative, and North Korea has been very unhappy with him, and they haven't really wanted to deal with him, and he hasn't really wanted to deal with them. But this has gone on since the Korean War. It's not a new issue. The clashes in the West Sea have been going on for years. And I'm not surprised that the caller was able to continue his interaction with North Korea. These kinds of things have been going on, agricultural aid, food aid. There are some Christian organizations that do humanitarian aid in North Korea, including medical aid, and these have gone on. And people often think that North Korea's policy is totally unified, but I don't think it is. That different parts of North Korean policy are compartmentalized, so the military can do one thing while the Ministry of Foreign Affairs is doing something else. And, you know, Ministry of Development is doing something else. So I think the caller's pretty much right on that.
Okay, thank you
All
very
right,
much.
Thank you. We'll go on to someone else here. This is a caller in Urbana, and it's line two. Hello.
Hi. I just want to bring up a little bit that what I've learned from reading of Bruce Cumings' writings. And he emphasizes in particular the trauma that existed in the Koreas due to the Korean War. And evidently, there never was a peace treaty that settled the Korean War. So the question is, as long as there's no peace treaty, you're going to have these incidents happening, it seems to me. So what is the prospect, according to our guest here, of there being a settlement to end the Korean War, which was never really ended?
Right, the caller is correct. The Korean War ended with an armistice. The armistice was between China, the U.S., and North Korea. The South Korean government at the time refused to participate in the armistice, so they're not an official part of it. There's never been a peace treaty ending the Korean War. If the six-party talks had succeeded, there was talk about creating a overarching political structure that would have included a peace treaty and some kind of organization to deal with tensions, but the talks never succeeded. So that's been an issue on the burner for some time.
Does that get at your question, Connor? You want to follow?
I guess so. I guess so, but I just think that to understand North Korea, you have to understand the psychology which emanated from that war, and we don't seem to understand that very well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's all I wanted.
Well,
the war was traumatic for both North and South Korea, and it affects both of their relationships. And the reaction to the current shelling, the most severe reaction, was Korean War veterans in South Korea. They were the ones who were demanding very strong military reaction. So the trauma was on both sides.
Hmm. And I think, you know, there are some people who would argue that while, you know, some people say the country that here that is in the position to have the greatest influence, well, over the North would be China, and that perhaps the country that would be in the position to have the greatest influence over the South would be the United States, and would talk about the important role that these other countries, that the countries involved in the talks would have. But ultimately, I think there are a lot of people would say, you know, at the end of the day, the problem of Korea is something that's going to have to be worked out by the Koreans. And that ultimately, if there's going to be any reconciliation between the North and the South, it's going to have to be worked out between the people of the North and the South. But, you know, having said that, and also your response to the last caller would make it suggest that that kind of a thing, you know, could still be a long way away.
Yeah, North and South Koreans, they've had a lot more contact since 2000 when President Kim Dae-jung visited North Korea. And they issued a six-point declaration, which the North Koreans mentioned in their New Year's address on 2011. So the North Koreans are still interested in that kind of interaction. They would like aid from South Korea. South Korea is realizing, I think, the new president that a hard line doesn't lead anywhere. And there are more talks between North and South Korea now than there were immediately after his inauguration. So I think there's going to be more progress on that issue as we move into the new year. I think the prospects for talks starting at lower levels and working up is relatively good.
We have another caller here. This is someone in Champaign County, here where we are, line one. Hello.
Yeah, your first caller called into question the report on the sinking of the boat, the South Korean boat, and I think that's quite a fair point. But and when, there might be one irony that it might have been unexploded mine from the never-ending war that's still going on that has not been settled. What I learned from Bruce Cummings, I think, is that the decimation in the north was beyond decimation. It was something like 30% of the population. I don't know if it's comparable in the south, but that's a staggering figure. So there certainly was suffering on both sides. And the point I wanted to make is that there was also a sinking of a North Korean boat. It was cut in half, I guess, as well. I'm not sure how it went down. It was some in the previous year, and it's never mentioned in the discourse about the South Korean boat. The unsettled maritime borders is certainly the case, but it seems to me that everything that North Korea done is a provocation, but massive annual and even more than annual military maneuvers go ahead without a settlement. It's belligerence on both sides. Belligerence that we see is the North Koreans, and one doesn't comment so much on the fact that if there were massive military maneuvers in the Caribbean by whomever, the U.S. would take umbrage at that. And I think that Chalmers Johnson, the late Chalmers Johnson, is very good at pointing that out. So if people want to hear a Korean War veteran talk about he's an interesting source, not only available in his writings and his YouTube videos. So I guess I'll hang around and listen to how you respond.
I think you have some good points there. The clashes in the Yellow Sea have been on both sides. The South Koreans did sink a North Korean naval vessel a couple of years ago, and that's why I think the sinking of the Chun'an may very well have been retaliation rather than some unprovoked provocation. I think it's unlikely that it was a mine that sank the Chun'an, however, because the evidence was that whatever went in broke the boat in two, and that's not usually what mines would do. So, no question that the clashes in the Yellow Sea have been on both sides.
And just, I'm looking at a map here that shows the line, and it's this, I don't know, it's this odd rambling sort of line that goes through the Yellow Sea that's the extension of the DMZ, the line between the north and the south, and I would imagine that it might be difficult to decide which side of the line you were on, depending on where you were.
Well, that's an issue, there's also the issue of international law, that line was drawn according to, general accepted principles of international law. North Koreans' position is that although those islands are South Koreans' possessions, they are entirely surrounded by North Korean territorial waters, so that anything the South Koreans do there is in North Korean territorial waters, which is a somewhat odd contention since it's almost impossible, according to international law, to have somebody's territory inside someone else's territorial water. Mm-hmm. So this dispute has been going on since the Korean War, until North and South Korea can come together and negotiate it, it will continue.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Clark Sorensen. He is associate professor in the Henry M. Jackson School of International Studies. That's at the University of Washington in Seattle, and has been studying and following Korea for a long time, both North and South. And we're talking about North Korea, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And here's another caller in Champaign. It's line number two. Hello.
Morning.
Yes.
These are two questions that sort of are oriented towards the future. One would be your thoughts on how analogous you find the situation in with U.S. troops in Germany during the Cold War and U.S. troops now in South Korea in terms of there being sort of, I don't know, quotation marks, hostages or a tripwire for, like, further involvement of the United States? And relatedly, how the totalitarian regime would react. The DMZ is not exactly a wall like the Berlin Wall that can come down, but is there much impetus, do you think, in the North Korea? Do they know enough about South Korea that they might be impelled to, like, you know, raise their standard of living and go to a better, more free form of life in that, in an, you know, an amalgamated country, and how China would view that? And then another one, just peripherally, if there was a nuclear exchange, you know, if we felt impelled to use United States atomic weaponry against North Korea for some reason or other, which way do the winds blow? Would China feel a lot of fallout from there? Would Japan? You know, and those are my two questions. I was just hanging up and listening to you to respond. Thank you very much.
All right.
North Korea announced that it wants to raise its standard of living. This is the 100th year of the birth of Kim Il-sung, who was the founder of their present regime. So they've announced that this is going to be the great upsurge to improvement of the standard of living. I'm not sure they have the resources to actually do that. There hasn't been a lot of movement toward Chinese-style reform in recent years. In 2002, it looked like they were moving that direction, but since 2005, it seems like they've been moving toward reconstituting the old system. North Korean people seem to know a lot about South Korea now. They're pirated South Korean videos that are said to be available in North Korea. There's Radio Free Asia and so forth. So they know South Korea is more prosperous than them. So far as the North Korean government is concerned, independence and maintaining their own way of life is more important than anything else. And they would like to raise the standard of living, but not at the cost of losing their governing system. So it seems like an impasse. As for a nuclear exchange, heaven forbid that a nuclear exchange should ever take place. As far as prevailing winds, it depends upon what time of year you're talking about. In the summer, the winds go to the north so that they would bring fallout toward the mainland. In the winter, the winds come to the south, so they would bring it out over the Pacific and Japan. So it just depends upon what time of year you're talking about.
And what about the question of the presence of American troops, whether you can argue either that's a good thing for having maintained stability or that it's a bad thing because it is a potential source of friction and maybe even escalation if something should happen?
Well, the North Koreans consider it a source of friction, of course. They talk about the South Korean government conniving with foreign power to keep the peninsula divided and so forth. So they would prefer U.S. troops to withdraw. I think that's something that the United States should think about. Not a precipitous withdrawal, but South Korea is a pretty militarily strong country that might very well be able to defend itself. And if that would lead toward a normalization, that might work. North Korea has on the table since 1980 a vision of what they call the Democratic Federal Republic of Koryo, which is a kind of one-state, two-systems model. The South Koreans at the time responded with a looser confederal proposal. So there are things like that that have been proposed, and North Korea is still talking about them. So there's kinds of things that might happen, but the talks really need to get started first. Mm-hmm. North Korea has tended to want an overall settlement first and deal with the details later. South Korea has tended to want to work up from small cooperation toward larger cooperation. And so, in general, they've made some progress, but not a lot of progress.
Another caller, someone in Chicago. Let's go there, line four. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. I'm not so much worried about a war in Korea because I think that would be a catastrophe for them. And we could probably win that war within 3 months. What I'm wondering is if North Korea gets nuclear weapons, do we have to worry about them selling them to a terrorist group who then might use them on Israel or the United States? I wonder if you could comment on that.
That's one of the main worries the United States has. I think the consensus in the U.S. that we could probably live with a nuclear North Korea, since they can't use the weapons without risking nuclear war on the Korean Peninsula. The Korean Peninsula is small. North Korea is about the size of Minnesota. South Korea is about the size of Indiana. There's 70 million people that live in that small area. So it would be a disaster for either side, and they know that. I think they want it for defensive purposes, just to say to the U.S., don't push us around. Don't think you can overthrow us. And the U.S. could probably live with that, but we are worried about proliferation. North Korea does export missiles around the world to people we'd rather not have them.
Well, they make their living selling arms, do they not? I mean, if you can sell 50,000 AK-47s to Iraq or Iran, why not a nuclear weapon to Al-Qaeda?
Right. I don't know if it's much of a living, but they do sell arms. We worry that they would be tempted to sell nuclear material because they have so few things that they can sell and their economy is in such shambles.
Yeah, that could be a catastrophe for Israel, or if you, God forbid, you'd see a yellow
model
for New York.
The U.S. has called the PSI, Proliferation Security Initiative, which involves monitoring ships coming out of North Korea and even boarding ships on the high seas if necessary. And there was a shipment of material that was impounded in Bangkok on the basis of that. So people are paying attention to that. The U.S. is paying attention
well,
to that.
Isn't it
nobody's thinking about it.
Isn't it a fact that in 1994 the Clinton people actually drew up plans to take military action against North Korea if there was no other way to keep nuclear weapons out of their hands?
Right, and if Jimmy Carter hadn't visited North Korea in 1994, those plans may very well have gone through.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. One of the things that I came across in trying to read up on the subject was apparently something that came out of the one of the WikiLeaks revelations, and that it was a comment from a Chinese diplomat talking about the issue of North Korea, saying that what the North Koreans really wanted was recognition from the United States. Now, that's certainly complicated by nuclear weapons, and it's not likely that the United States would recognize North Korea unless North Korea had made the pledge to get rid of their nuclear weapons, which, for a variety of reasons, they're maybe not likely to do. But this goes, again, it goes back to this question, well, who has any sort of leverage over North Korea? And we presume that the party that has the greatest leverage are the Chinese. But this would, if indeed one of the things that North Korea is interested in is recognition from the United States and perhaps a kind of a pledge from the United States that that we are not interested in attacking them, that makes you think, maybe it makes it just as complex or more complex, but it makes you think a little bit differently about this question, well, who is it that's got influence?
Right. Normalization of relations between the United States and North Korea has been on the table for a long time. The U.S. has always wanted denuclearization to be a precondition for that. We have almost established relations with them several times since 1994, but something always comes in the way. There was in 1994 or so, I can't remember, 1995, 1996, we were prepared to establish a liaison office in Pyongyang, and we were even looking for space in Pyongyang, and then that fell through because Pyongyang really didn't want to have an office in Washington, D.C., either because they couldn't afford it or some other reason, so that fell through. So normalization is certainly something that we should look forward to. The question is how to attain it, and do we want to do normalization before denuclearization or use it as part of a package of carrots in order to induce North Korea to denuclearize.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Clark Sorensen. He's an associate professor in the Jackson School of International Studies, University of Washington, Seattle. We're talking about Korea, and we have maybe about 5 or 6 minutes left. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. A little bit earlier in the conversation, we talked about the interest that we have and people in the West have trying to understand
who exactly it is that's running the country in North Korea. And there, as I said, there has been a lot of interest in this question of who is it that will succeed Kim Jong-il. And last fall, it at least looked like the heir was going to be one of his sons, Kim Jong-un, although in reporting on this, I think more recently, there people seem to be raising some questions about whether, in fact, that is going to be the case, whether he has enough support within the military and the government to take over from his father and so forth. And I wonder what, if anything, can be said about this. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about Kim Jong-un, what we know about him.
Yeah, actually, we know very little about Kim Jong-un. He's the second son by Kim Jong-il's second wife. So he's actually Kim Jong-il's third son. His oldest son, which people thought, his oldest son by his first wife, which some people thought would be the successor, Kim Jong-nam, is a quite sophisticated guy who speaks English and French. And he was caught in Japan taking his family to visit, he claimed, Disneyland in Tokyo. And he's been out of the succession since then. He's kind of a playboy now, hangs out in Macau. The second son, Kim Jong-chul, the rumor is that Kim Jong-il thinks he's too effeminate to be the leader of North Korea. So he went to school in Switzerland for 2 or 3 years and was spotted with his girlfriend going to Sting concerts in West Germany for a while. His younger brother went to school in Switzerland for about a year or maybe a year and a half. He's about 27 or 28. We've seen very, very few pictures of him. The rumors are, and, you know, we get these rumors from a book written by Kim Jong-il's Japanese chef after he went back to Japan. So, you know, the sources aren't exactly abundant. That he's a kind of a hardliner after Kim Jong-il's hard, and Jong-il thinks he's the kind of guy who ought to lead the country. But there was no official announcement at the party deputies conference last fall. There might not have been a public announcement even if he was made the official successor. So there's just a lot of speculation going on.
Mm-hmm. Well, even if you, I guess you would have to think that even if his father thought that Kim Jong-un was the guy who had what it takes to be the next leader of Korea, that he's quite young, and that there would be, he would have to have the support of support of the military, he'd have to have the support of other people in government, which would be the kind of thing one might have to build, and could take some time, even if that was possible. And I would imagine there would be other people who might think, well, there would be others who would be better suited to lead the country. And that's just something we just don't know.
One can only speculate. Yeah. Kim Jong-il himself was groomed for this succession over a period of 20 years. He was named official successor in 1980, and that was about 7 years after he appeared on the scene publicly. Kim Jong-un doesn't have that much time. Kim Jong-il's health is poor. He may only last another couple of years. And you're right, it may be hard for Kim Jong-un at such a young age to consolidate his position. Some of the interesting things that happened at the party's conference is that the Politburo of the party was reconstituted. It was down to 5 people when the party conference was done. Now it's up to 16 people. And interestingly enough, Kim Jong-il put his younger sister, Kim Kyung-hee, on the Politburo, and his younger sister's husband, Chang Song-taek, on the military commission, and the military commission is where the real power is in North Korea. And people are speculating that Kim Kyung-hee and Chang Song-taek are kind of regents who will ensure that the succession is carried out according to Kim Jong-il's will if he dies. That's just speculation, but interesting stuff.
Well, that it does indeed raise the question about what would happen at the point where Kim Jong-il does die, does pass from the scene, if the position of Kim Jong-un is not all that strong.
Right. Kim Jong-il's younger sister is an interesting woman. She's said to have a very, very strong personality, and nobody pushes her around. And if you take precedence of the old Joseon dynasty, she might actually rule in the background. It's kind of an interesting possibility.
Hmm. Well, we're just about at the point that we have to finish up. Maybe any last thought, particularly about where things stand now in relations between South Korea, and the United States?
It's interesting. During the period when South Korea had sunshine policy, which was 2000 to 2008, we had the Bush administration, which was more hawkish on North Korean issues. And so there was quite a bit of tension between South Korea and the United States on those issues. Now it seems to be the opposite. The Lee Myung-bak administration is rather conservative and somewhat hawkish on these issues, whereas the U.S., to the extent it has a coherent policy, and we haven't exactly had a policy paper on North Korea in recent years. The tables are turned. Now the United States may be more anxious to have negotiations than South Korea. There's not as much tension between South Korea and the United States as there was during the Sunshine Policy, because we're not at odds with each other. But on the other hand, there's not much progress in either of our relationship with North Korea. And negotiations really have to start again. There's no alternative. We've found that during lack of negotiations, North Korea just goes ahead with their nuclear program and makes it better, and they continue their missile programs and make them better. So lack of negotiations doesn't seem a viable policy. When we've negotiated, we've seemed to have made progress, although at the last minute, some things always seem to go wrong. So we need to really get a policy that's neither a hawkish or dovish policy that includes negotiations, of course, both carrots plus a few sticks, in a way that would improve things.
We'll have to leave it at that. Professor Sorensen, thanks very much for talking with us.
Okay.
Our guest, Clark Sorensen, is associate professor in the Henry Jackson School of International Studies, University of Washington at Seattle.